In 2007, on a hot summer day in Baghdad, a Reuters photographer, Namir, and his assistant, Saeed, leave their office for a report. It's about 1 o'clock in the afternoon and extremely hot. Saeed carries his camera on his shoulder as he walks through the twisting alley. Namir hurries to get the car started. The street is almost empty. Only a few people are walking along the wall shadows. About an hour ago, gunfire was heard from a nearby street. But now, it's almost quiet. Nothing is heard but a helicopter hovering over the region. Suddenly, shooting breaks out in the neighborhood. Bullets fly all over the place, hitting the ground, clay walls. Vision gets weak. The fire shots continue. Bullets are shot towards Saeed, Namir, and other passerby. Everything is in chaos. In a single moment, several bodies are ripped and scattered. Screams and cries now accompany the sound of gunfire. It's a confusing situation. People are running in different directions to keep themselves safe and out of the range of the 30mm cannon bullets fired from the Apache helicopter.
He's carrying a camera. That's the camera that he has right there. They mistake it as an RPG.
In that group are two Reuters journalists from Baghdad, a photographer, Namir, and his driver and assistant, Saeed. Namir is walking towards a corner with his camera strapped over his shoulder, and the Apache asks and gets permission to engage or open fire to shoot with its 30mm cannon shells that are this big, the entire group. By that stage, there are about nine people together, including Namir and Saeed, and they are all mowed down, all killed.
And then there's RPG standing, the guy with the RPG right here. See him carrying the RPG? And then he drops the RPG right against the wall. See, he's already wounded to keep firing on him. I don't think it was necessary. He was already wounded.
The U.S. helicopter's sudden attack on the Reuters photographer and his assistant continues relentlessly. Even Saeed's half-dead body crawling to a corner for cover is not spared. They want to make sure he's dead.
I can tell you from coming up on the scene, his right leg is almost taken completely off.
So what's this rule of engagement that you're not allowed to help?
It's more along the lines of the Geneva Convention. If you don't have a red crescent or a red cross on your vehicle and you go picking up the bodies, you can be fired on. Just for the simple fact that you could be picking up the bodies and the weapons as well. So. Is it right? I don't think so, because this guy is just trying to be a good Samaritan. I mean, he has his children in the van with him.
Where's that van at? Right down there by the body. Okay, yeah. We have crazy noise. We have individuals going to the scene. Looks like possibly off.
The U.S. soldiers on board the Apache helicopter will not let anyone approach Namir or Saeed for help. They must not survive. So they even open fire on the vehicle of a family who has stopped to help the wounded. The father and his two sons inside the van are shot.
Clear. Clear.
And they're still, even though they just said that the van's disabled, they're still firing on it. Just imagine being those two children in there.
It must be a lovely feeling that you've saved two people. Whatever it is.
And we're going to come up on the scene from up here.
What time was it?
It's about 1 o'clock in the afternoon.
Everyone else is dead. This is not a combat situation. And just before was also not a combat situation. A van then sees him driving past. Two men get out of the van and they see a man wounded on the gutter. They go to pick him up and put him in the van. In the front seat of the van, you can just glimpse two children. The men rescuing Saeed look up and see the helicopter, and presumably wondering how the other people died, so they're a bit suspicious about it. The helicopter then asks for permission to open fire on a van which is collecting the wounded and collecting the dead.
I'm at the van pulling them out now. That's me running with them. That's the boy. Yeah, the girl was the first one, the boy was the second one. Right there, I'm talking to him.
The helicopter then pursues two pedestrians seeking refuge in a building there and gets command approval to fire missiles and destroy the building.
They then see two other men go in, both of which no sign of carrying arms, and they ask for permission to engage that building with a Hellfire missile. Now, they do say they had seen six men go in there altogether. Before the two, so eight men altogether into the building. However, there is not sign in the video, at least, that there have been previous men going into the building.
Overall, this attack by the Apache helicopter kills a dozen people, among them the Reuters photographer and his assistant. A year later, this terrible crime is disclosed in a website, but what WikiLeaks reveals is only a brief glimpse of reality.
See, they cut out of this video, they cut a bunch of pieces out. Like us coming up to the van, they cut that out. The longer version.
First off, to say that there's a little bit more context to that video that's not shown, and there were soldiers on the ground around the corner with the helicopter that was shown, so that, militarily speaking, the people in the Apache responded how they had been trained to. That's not to morally justify it, but that's to explain.
See that right there? That's self-justifying what they did. They cut out the part where they said there's a small girl wounded and he goes, oh, damn, and starts showing his emotions. I think they could have done it a little bit more responsibly, WikiLeaks, the way they did it. Just the title, Collateral Murder, is a little hard to swallow, but and in their video, you see that they make sure to point out cameras, but they don't point out the weapons as well. This isn't all black and white. There's a lot of gray area in it, and it still makes me sick to my stomach. And
the more we looked, the worse it became, and we started to see that extraordinarily, that the two principal characters in this video, the two principal visual characters. Are Namir, one Reuters journalist, who runs off into a garbage dump when he's open fired upon and is individually attacked and killed, and Saeed, who is the wounded man. So extraordinarily powerful visual material. And we sent people to Baghdad over the weekend to get the backstory and further evidence. We interviewed the families. We just found the children. We got their hospital records. We took photos and videotape of their scars. And we also found that the Hellfire missile attack, the third event, was on a building which had three families in it. We have the death certificate for the wife of the owner. And he says that there's been two other women were killed.
The pilot and the Apache crew's oppressive act of violence in this operation raise possibilities about the attack being planned beforehand. They talk about this mission indifferently, and none were reprimanded or taken to court afterwards.
One of the investigation reports says that the permission to engage implies, or actually states directly, that the permission to engage was only given once Namir, the photographer, went around the corner and pointed his camera in the direction of US troops and started taking a photograph. That is not true. The Apache helicopter asks for permission to engage before Namir goes around the corner and is given permission to engage before Namir goes around the corner. So the alleged confusion of, well, he was pointing a camera towards a Bradley fighting vehicle or a Humvee, you know, an armored personal carrier, US armored personal carrier, two blocks away down the street, is false.
But the soldiers deployed to the region have a different story. They feel guilty in their own conscience when their commanders order such ruthless operations and forbid even wounded children to be taken to the hospital. Two soldiers decide to do something to compensate their mistakes.
If I asked myself the question, you know, would I want this done to me, the answer was no. So I got to the point where I said, you know, I can't keep doing this to other people if I wouldn't want it done to me. I'm being a hypocrite if I do otherwise when I think that. So I kind of struggled with how to actually put that into action and eventually learned about conscientious objection.
Violent attacks constantly occur in Iraq and Afghanistan. The people in these two countries do not consider the presence of U.S. troops as forces helping their country or bringing freedom and democracy for them, but as forces occupying their land.
When I talk to military audiences and they say, how come nobody ever prints on the paper a picture of an American soldier passing out candy? I said, I don't have the answer to that question, but let me take it a step farther. What is that child likely to remember more, the burned-out house of his next-door neighbors with the charred bodies in it, or the fact that somebody gave him a piece of candy?
You go to Walter Reed and you ask those soldiers, if they're proud to do what they did, and most of them are going to say, hell yeah, because it's hard to admit to yourself that you sacrificed so much, whether it was your friends, your limbs, your eyesight, your sanity, your innocence, and tell yourself that it was all for crap. You don't want to do that. Probably the last thing that keeps you sane is the holding on to the idea that it was the noble and right thing to do, and that you help people.
Many soldiers in Iraq and Afghanistan are now well aware the reason why they are in these countries is to preserve the wealth of the capitalists in Wall Street. They know that not only have they had no role in the development and freedom of these two countries, but that they've also have had no positive effect on preserving and guarding the security of the U.S.
We are having bases in over 100 countries around the world where people don't want us. So I think one of the measures of our security is to take a look and see, does having the largest military many times over of all the world, does having all of these bases around the world actually make us less safe rather than more safe?
The children were often barefoot running through open wastewater in the streets because, you know, at the time, I still didn't understand why that was the way it was, but due to U.S. bombings during the Gulf War and periodically through the 90s that destroyed the sanitation systems, the water systems, everything. So Iraq was just poor.
U.S. forces raids on people's homes in Iraq and Afghanistan and the growing number of civilian casualties have triggered a wave of anger and hatred against the inhuman acts of the U.S. government, both in this region and around the world. These imprudent acts have extended the roots of terrorism in different countries, and insecurity throughout the world has peaked ever since.
Terrorism was created in Iraq by the Western Alliance and the United States. In fact, in Afghanistan, terrorism was started by the CIA and their friends in the region there when they were arming Osama bin Laden and his groups and these groups in order to fight the Soviet Union. After the Soviet Union was defeated, they cut and run without taking care of the people of Afghanistan, and they left the country to Osama bin Laden and Taliban to rule. So I don't think they are fighting terrorism. They are not fighting for democracy.
In Iraq, I saw the completely opposite experience. I was hurting people. I was kicking down their doors. I was building distrust from the people I was supposedly bringing democracy to. And I saw that I was not being seen as a peacekeeper, but I was seen as an occupier and invader.
Since 2003, we're not including the years of bombings and sanctions that killed over 1 million Iraqis prior to the invasion of 2003. But if anyone is to think that this is for the liberation of the Iraqi people, when all you did was bomb the country mercilessly, kill over almost 1.5 million people, and then continue to repress and police the civilian population, kicking down people's doors in the middle of the night, dragging them out of their homes, sending them to detention facilities where they're tortured on absolutely no charge, there's no one who can actually go to that country and actually think that we're there for the Iraqi people.
You think about a country, Iraq, for example, 25 million people before the invasion. We've killed well over 1 million, probably closer to 1.5 million. 1/25 of the population dead. At least 5 million have been either internally displaced or refugee. At least. That is a very conservative figure. That's, you know, 1/5 of the population before the war, now displaced. We're talking about at least minimum 6 to 7 million people dead or displaced in a country that only started out with 25 million people. That is such an astronomical figure that it's hard to really wrap your mind around it. Not to mention the infrastructure damage that we did.
He was accused of killing 400,000 people in the 30 years that he was in power. The United States killed 400,000 Iraqis in the first 6 months we were there. We're far more efficient at killing Iraqis than Saddam Hussein ever was.
That a third of the Taliban are there because of revenge from foreign forces, not just America, but other foreign forces that have either killed their father or brother, or illegally detained their father and brother, or displaced them from their lands, and now they're upset, and so they join the Taliban because they want to fight foreign forces. So of course, to them, we could look like terrorists to them.
As protests against the U.S. government's inhumane acts are on the rise, violent and coercive methods are used to quell these protests in the occupied countries, in the USA itself, and even amongst intellectuals of this country. While U.S. military forces persecute people with all kinds of torture in Iraq and Afghanistan, police and security forces inside the U.S. crush protests with intimidation.
Between January and May of 2007, I was warned by my chain of command to curtail my political activities
in order to remain within Army regulations, which I did according to my reasonable interpretation of the orders I received. I quickly realized that the problem was not the manner in which I was exercising my First Amendment rights, but the substance of the speech itself. Suspended, and I was involuntarily discharged. I did not pursue an IG complaint for fear that I would be further retaliated against.
They referred to the Iraqi people as Hajis and could care less when we killed civilians. It was brushed off, and it was like, well, how does this affect our force? It was never, how does this affect the Iraqi people? The things that we're doing, how is this affecting the Iraqi people? When we lost electricity, it was about, well, my air conditioner's down. It wasn't about, well, the Iraqi people don't have electricity for most of their day.
I tried to contact a lot of local news media to talk about not only this incident, but my whole experience in Iraq and what I thought of it. And nobody had given me the forum. Nobody had talked to me. I'd never gotten any return phone calls or anything. But as soon as the WikiLeaks video came out, then everybody got a taste of war and everybody wants to know what's going on.
We got hold of the 2003 manual for Guantanamo Bay, which was authored by the then commander, General Miller. That is the same general who went to Abu Ghraib and set up Abu Ghraib in response to a request by Donald Rumsfeld saying, go to Abu Ghraib and gitmoise it. Turn it into another Gitmo. Take the lessons you have learned in Guantanamo Bay and apply them to Abu Ghraib. And those abuses in Abu Ghraib occurred after that. So it's very interesting to sort of look at the progression of this abuse. And we see for the initial 2003 manual for Guantanamo that there was a policy of hiding people from the Red Cross for 1 month, a breach of the Geneva Conventions.
That what occurred at Abu Ghraib was not an aberration, and it was not a bunch of bad apples on the night shift. What we saw was directly correlated with the policies, procedures, and the implementation of a torture program that was okayed at the very highest level of the American government, from the White House and the Pentagon, and those policies trickled down to Guantanamo Bay. They went through the CIA's so-called black site secret prisons. They showed up at Bagram in Afghanistan, and they showed up on paper and then on film in Abu Ghraib.
I remember my friend Magdad from the Iraqi police station in Hibhib. I got to talking to him a lot, and after Abu Ghraib scandal occurred, he just stopped talking to me. And this went on for maybe like 3 weeks that he just ignored me, he wouldn't talk to me. He was really upset. He was upset mostly about the Quran being defiled than of the naked human pyramids and the dogs and the torture and all that crap.
After the election of President Obama, whose main presidential campaign slogan was change, Americans and other people around the world expected change in the tragic situation in Iraq and Afghanistan. But unfortunately, so far, no sign of improvement has been witnessed.
The Obama administration says it has stopped the torture program in the United States. That is true on paper. In other words, Obama has signed an executive order that has stopped the torture program, at least as carried out by the CIA. The problem is that that's just a piece of paper. In other words, that is this president's policy to not torture, okay? Most of the, say, Republican presidential potential candidates for 2012 have all advocated torture. Under the Obama administration, not only are they the same as during the Bush administration, they're arguably worse. While the Obama administration is ostensibly not torturing people, they have increased the troop footprint in Afghanistan. They have drastically increased the use of unmanned drone strikes in countries other than Afghanistan and Iraq. And these are very aggressive national security policies that run the risk of a serious backlash against the Obama administration.